Cambridge, of course, is a great place in the Darwin story because it was really as a result of Fitzroy's search for a gentleman companion on the long second voyage that Henslow, a working scientist in the university at that time, was contacted on behalf of Fitzroy to see if he could recommend a naturalist to the expedition. And, of course, that is why there's such a strong Darwin connection here with the university. And today, of course, the university here is a great repository of Darwin manuscripts and other scientific material. And this afternoon, what we're here to do is to look at some of this material and see if we can get some insights into Darwin's relationship with the beagle. The Beagle's first voyage, under the command of Pringle Stokes, and then, after Stokes' suicide, of Captain Robert Fitzroy, had taken her to the southern tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego and Cape Horn. Her second voyage, which lasted nearly 5 years, would take her back to the coasts of South America, but it also included a circumnavigation of the globe to make a complete series of longitudinal measurements and greatly improve the accuracy of the nautical charts of the time.
On top of this, Fitzroy decides he's going to have a complete scientific expedition.
Professor Keith Thompson is the author of the book HMS Beagle, The Story of Darwin's Ship.
So he needs a naturalist, and he needs seven guns, and he needs an artist, and he needs a fiddler to the poop cabin. He needs to take all the chronometers, and he needs to take an instrument maker to maintain them for 5 years. And a lot of this is done at his own expense, but he's going to do everything absolutely right. This is a very dramatic story. And the whole story of why Darwin was chosen in the first place is still very contentious. Was he chosen because he was a brilliant naturalist, or was it because he was a well-bred young man who could be Fitzroy's companion for 5 years, so that Fitzroy knew that all his uncles had committed suicide, and eventually did commit suicide himself, to sort of maintain his mental health. It goes on and on and on.
Accommodation on the ship was very cramped. There wasn't a lot of space, and a good many people had to be fitted in. I'm keen to gain an insight into Darwin's life on board the Beagle, which is why I'm here, a place only about 40 miles from the site where HMS Beagle spent her later years as a Coast Guard watch vessel in Essex. I'm standing outside the imposing building of Cambridge University Library, where many of Darwin's original letters are kept, and I've come to meet Professor Jim Secord, director of the Darwin Correspondence Project, which is transcribing and publishing, both in print and online, every letter which still exists which was sent by or to Charles Darwin. I'm actually sitting in front of this wonderful sketch plan of the poop cabin, which is the accommodation, of course, that Darwin occupied jointly with two other officers of the ship.
Yes, it's, I think, very interesting that the room is so dominated by a big table, because, of course, this was used for drawing maps and plans, and it was also a place that Darwin himself worked very actively when he was working on the collections he had made during the course of the Beagle, writing up his diary and writing letters home. So it was very important. It was a real working space, an office in some ways. But it was, of course, also his bedroom. He had his hammock was immediately above the table, and he describes how he's feeling very ill, and he's having to swing back and forth in his hammock with the officers underneath him drawing maps and plans and so forth. So it's quite a small, cramped, crowded space.
Well, he's just had a very short trip out at this point, and in light of his later trouble with seasickness, this is rather an ironic remark, because he writes to one of his sisters, "As for seasickness, I utterly scorn the very name of it." Well, he changed his mind pretty quickly, very soon after that.
Many of the letters at Cambridge University Library are on loan from English Heritage's collection at Darwin's home, Down House in Kent. Dr. Alison Pern is Assistant Director of the Darwin Correspondence Project.
And I think we have another letter somewhere that actually describes his seasickness to his father. So He says, nobody who's only been to sea for 24 hours, which is pretty much what he had been when he wrote the previous letter, has a right to say that
seasickness is even uncomfortable. The real misery only begins when you are so exhausted that a little exertion makes a feeling of faintness come on. I found nothing but lying in my hammock did me any good.
And that's a constant, that's a recurring theme, really, seasickness throughout the voyage for Darwin. He never did get over it.
I often think of Darwin sitting in the corner of the room, which is, of course, devoted to another purpose, which is map-making. So this table has lots of maps and rules and things like that on it, and Darwin is sitting in the corner with his own thing.
Dr. John Van Wy is a historian of science at Cambridge University and director of Darwin Online, a project which is putting all Darwin's publications on the internet along with his diary and notebooks.
He's got his microscope, perhaps, set up on... probably he had it set up on wooden blocks by the ship's carpenter so that he could have little armrests to either side to support his arms during hours of dissecting. So there he sits in this tiny corner, forced to be constrained in terms of how much space he can have for his notes and his specimens and his instruments like a microscope. So, as Darwin says many times later in his life, my education as a naturalist began really seriously on the voyage of the Beagle, and 5 years of hard thinking, reading, collecting, and describing happens largely in this small cabin, where he's forced to be constrained by space.
But despite the cramped conditions and the seasickness, the voyage was made tolerable for Darwin, indeed enjoyable, by the company of Beagle's commander, Captain Robert Fitzroy. The two young men took their meals together in the captain's cabin, and as the voyage progressed, they struck up a close, if occasionally volatile, friendship.
Yes, Darwin, both during the voyage and many years later, looking back over his life, commented on Fitzroy's character. He said that in some ways he was the noblest character I ever knew, very like a gentleman. But he also thought that Fitzroy had profound character flaws. He had a very abrupt temper. He could be very unreasonable when he was angry, in Darwin's view. But he also, his anger would subside almost as quickly as it arose, and he would often send for Darwin, send one of the crewmen to apologise and invite Darwin back to his table. And they did get along very well, and we only have small glimpses of the amiable friendship that these two young men shared, especially from these letters that Fitzroy has left behind.
One of the things I think it's really important to recognise is being on a ship like this, they really, both men, Fitzroy and Darwin, had to work very hard to be friends and to continue to work together all the time. And I think one thing that comes across in the tone of many of the letters is just how close they actually were. They had joking names for one another. Darwin, generally on the ship, was called Philos, the philosopher, because of his natural history instincts. And this letter here of 4th of October, 1833, is from Fitzroy, just really writing to Darwin just to check up on how he's been doing on some of his land-based expeditions while the ship has been surveying. He says, "But firstly, of the first... My good Philos, why have you told me nothing of your hairbreadth escapes and moving accidents?
How many times did you flee from the Indians? How many precipices did you fall over? How many bogs did you fall into? How often were you carried away by the floods? And how many times were you killed? That you were not killed dead, I have visible evidence in your handwriting."
People always say, you know, who would you like to have dinner with from history and so on? I would have liked to have sat at the table in Fitzroy's cabin just one day for a meal. the interaction between those sort of ultimate odd couple, one an ardent Tory, one a very strongly minded Whig, you can see Fitzroy as sort of the small, dapper, dark sort of Norman type, and Darwin the tall, square-faced, blonde-haired Saxon type. I mean, they're completely opposite. And they learn to get on extraordinarily well. And they had these terrible rows, like over slavery, but they always seem to come back together and really like each other.
There is one letter at the time when Fitzroy was contemplating resignation. Darwin writes home again to one of his sisters and describes the whole story. And he says the captain was afraid that his mind was becoming deranged, being aware of his hereditary predisposition. So there was, they had clearly been talking about Fitzroy's fears for his own mental health. And of course, we have the correspondence that goes on between them later on in life, after the Beagle voyage, where their relationship does really rather deteriorate. And the letters when Darwin hears of Fitzroy's death, which was a suicide, of course, because he really had become mentally deranged. And they're very touching letters. And Darwin reflects on his relationship with Fitzroy at the time of the Beagle voyage and remembers the good times as well as the bad.
The voyage of the Beagle has been by far the most important event in my life and has determined my whole career. I have always felt that I owe to the voyage the first real training or education of my mind. I was led to attend closely to several branches of natural history, and thus my powers of observation were improved, though they were always fairly developed.
It's a nice little touch at the end there. Now, at the time that Darwin wrote the passage about the significance to him of the voyage of the Beagle, he was living at Down House, of course, on the southern fringes of the city of London today, but then in a country parish. And the Beagle was lying in an Essex river about 30-odd miles away, I think, it's so close, and yet he never records his awareness of that fact, if he was aware of it. He never visited the site to look at the ship again, and there's a very interesting sense in which, although the voyage had been so important, the ship may not have been a thing that survived in his affections much beyond the point where he stepped ashore and never went to sea again.
And I think his feelings about ships and the sea are fairly clear in some of his later letters. So at the point in the voyage when he'd already rather expected to have been returning home and they'd gone back to do some of the surveying again, he wrote home, "This zigzag manner of proceeding is very grievous. It has put the finishing stroke to my feelings. I loathe, I abhor the sea and all ships which sail on it." So that might be why he never went back to it. And he also, I think that it sounds as if the Beagle itself was in a bit of a bad state by this time. He wrote back in March 1835 to his cousin, "I wonder if I shall see you." He's talking now very excitedly about getting home. "I wonder if I shall see you.
If you continue to reside in the Isle of Wight, perhaps it will be in Portsmouth. If a dirty little vessel with her old rigging worn to shreds comes into harbour September 1836, you may know it is the Beagle.